Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Stronger Minds with me, Kimberly Wilson. I'm a chartered practitioner, psychologist, and author with a master's degree in nutrition. So I talk about psychology, mental health, food, and everything in between. The aim is that you leave this short podcast informed and in possession of some helpful, practical tips to support your well-being. This is part two of the Brain Health Q&A, and I'll be covering binge eating and the links between stress and dementia. So let's get started. Question one is, could you overview how not socializing affects the brain and what different things this leads to? I'm going to interpret this question as asking about the effects of loneliness on the brain, because of course, there are lots of perfectly healthy reasons not to socialize, including resting after a period of being very social. So if we start with a clinical definition of loneliness, it's the discrepancy between your preferred and actual social relations. The UK government's loneliness strategy defines it as, quote, a subjective, unwelcome feeling of lack or loss of companionship. It happens when we have a mismatch between the quantity and quality of social relationships that we have and those that we want, end quote. So it's a subjective rating, and there are lots of different dimensions of loneliness, which I won't have time to go into here. But loneliness scales will ask things like, how often do you feel left out? To which the answers are hardly ever or never, some of the time or often. Loneliness has been associated with a range of negative mental health outcomes, including poorer sleep, faster cognitive decline, increased risk of dementia, depression and anxiety, as well as reduced lifespan. But why should this be? It's understood that loneliness is harmful because it's a signal of danger. Humans are a social species, and while you might sometimes wish that the people around you would shut up and go away, we of course need each other. Babies, for example, are born utterly helpless, and during our evolution as a species, cooperation would have been essential for hunting, gathering, protection from predators and enemies, and so on. In short, being part of the group, being connected, means safety, and being separated or isolated means danger. So loneliness switches on the stress response, and physiologically, this is where we encounter the harms of loneliness, because chronic stress is bad for the body, brain, and mental health. So as an example, loneliness increases the functional connectivity in the visual parts of the brain. In psychological terms, we link this to what's called hypervigilance, which is a kind of anxious watchfulness where you're always on guard. Again, from an evolutionary perspective, this makes a lot of sense because if you were out in the wilderness by yourself, you'd have to pay much more attention to threats compared to if you were with a group. But this hypervigilance also leads to the person experiencing the world as more threatening and then interpreting things in a way that confirms that. So the world essentially becomes more dangerous and more frightening when you feel alone. And that's partly because your brain is focusing on the negatives just in case in order to protect you. Additionally, there is increased cortisol production and higher levels of inflammatory cytokines, which have negative effects on neurotransmitter synthesis and can alter the structure and function of the hippocampus, which is the brain's memory center. Next question. Will years of anxiety disorder and panic attacks, about a decade, basically mean dementia for me? I think this question was on a related theme, as in, if anxiety equals stress, does a decade of being stressed mean that I'm destined to develop dementia? Of course, it's impossible to answer this question with any certainty. And moreover, I really want people to understand that when I say increased risk of, that's very different from saying definitely will happen. They're very, very different statements. So for example, someone who smokes has an increased risk of lung cancer, but of course many, many smokers will never develop the disease. So while anxiety in the research literature does increase the risk of dementia, it doesn't definitely mean it will happen. But perhaps if this is the case for you, if it's something that you're concerned about, then your experience of anxiety or your concerns about it are encouragement for you to do whatever you can to help to build cognitive reserve and support your long-term brain health. And these things are things that I focus on in my first book, How to Build a Healthy Brain. The next question is, what does being in love mean for the brain? The neurochemistry of love is really interesting. When researchers look at the brains of people who are madly in love and looking at pictures of their beloveds, the areas of the brain associated with reward light up. This has led some to consider the period of falling in love to be a kind of addiction. And if you've ever fallen in love, I'm sure you can sympathize. Essentially, dopamine is in charge, which makes you feel euphoric and preoccupied with the focus of your affection. And two other hormones are also increased, oxytocin and vasopressin, which play important roles in attachment, pair bonding, and sexual desire. Okay, next question. How do you lower homocysteine? How do you test for homocysteine? Or once it's high, are you doomed? So, homocysteine is a naturally occurring amino acid, which is part of a protein, and at high levels, it's associated with a higher risk of cardiovascular disease and dementia. So it is considered a biomarker for these conditions, or the risk of these conditions, but it's not clear whether it's a cause or a consequence. So for example, the fact that there are always firefighters at the scene of a fire doesn't necessarily mean that they cause the blaze. So that's still an ongoing question in the research. In terms of testing, homocysteine is not something that is routinely tested for. And you will not, for example, be advised to have a test unless you fall into a high risk category, such as having a high risk of heart disease or stroke, being malnourished, and I'll explain that in a moment, being an older adult or having a history of drug or alcohol misuse. So in terms of nourishment, as I say, high homocysteine is considered an indicator of risk, but the very good news is that the B vitamins 6, 9 and 12 convert homocysteine into methionine, which is an essential amino acid, one that your body needs, or cysteine, which among other things is a precursor to one of your body's main antioxidants, which is called glutathione. So having enough B vitamins can detoxify, can transform homocysteine into actually helpful compounds. You can make sure you're getting enough folic acid or folate, which is B9, by eating leafy green vegetables, fruits, nuts, legumes, and fortified cereals. B12 is found in animal foods, and in the general population, deficiency is rare in those who eat meat and dairy. Though older adults are at higher risk as the ability to absorb B12 reduces with age, and vegans or people who rarely eat animal foods are advised to take a B12 supplement. So to answer the question, no, you're not doomed. Homocysteine levels can be lowered with a sufficient intake of B vitamins, which may be easily achieved through the diet or supplementation. Okay, it's time to take a short break.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The advertisements you heard there are automatically generated, so I have absolutely no idea what they're for. You'll get a different one depending on where you are in the world. If you would prefer an ad-free listening experience, or you simply enjoy the podcast, you find it valuable, perhaps you're someone who has used my resources in the classroom or with your own clients, please consider becoming a patron. It's the price of a hot chocolate once a month and allows me to sustain the podcast. But if that's not accessible to you, you can always listen to the free feed, which is the one you're listening to right now, which is the same content. If you're interested in becoming a patron, it's patreon.com/Kimberly Wilson, and that's Kimberly with an L-E-Y. Next question. Can we do anything to moderate the reward system in the brain? So I'm not entirely sure of the context here, but technically, yes. In behavioral models of psychology, the type of reinforcement that follows a behavior affects how rewarding it is. So, for example, when you're training a dog to sit and they sit successfully, you give them a treat. So you're reinforcing the behavior that you want to see. But if you don't give them a treat, then you disincentivize that behavior. But conversely, you can also reward negative behaviors. So if you give them a treat when they run off or when they bark, you're reinforcing the undesired behavior. So yes, obviously humans are a bit more complicated, but the basic principle still applies. And I suppose addiction could be considered a kind of moderation of the reward system, in that with many addictions, there is a tolerance that builds up, which means that a larger quantity of either the substance or the behavior, or a higher intensity of the behavior, is required to achieve the same high. Okay, so our last question: how are food binges or addictions created in the brain, and can you ever overcome them? I will say that there's still some controversy over whether eating addiction is the correct terminology, so I'll focus here on binge eating disorder or compulsive eating. And it's probably worth distinguishing between overeating and binging as it's seen in binge eating disorder. We all overeat from time to time, and usually we do it very knowingly. So, for example, at feasting occasions like weddings, birthday parties, Christmas, Thanksgiving, that kind of thing, we'll often have a light breakfast because we know that we will overeat on delicious things at the event. And that behavior is considered very normal, absolutely fine, not a problem. But clinically, binge eating or binge eating disorder is characterized by recurrent bouts of eating large quantities of food very quickly and feeling out of control. People will often eat until they are uncomfortably full, and these bouts of eating are followed by negative feelings such as shame, guilt, disgust, and low mood or depression. Now, there isn't a clear equation for how someone develops binge eating disorder. There are some risk factors, so things that will make it more likely, though of course, as I mentioned earlier, that doesn't mean that someone will definitely go on to develop the condition. The risk factors for binge eating disorder are vast, and they include a family history of eating disorders, so perhaps some genetic component, being in a situation or environment where there is pressure to be slim, so athletes or dancers, traumatic experiences either in childhood or in adulthood, and in adulthood is often within 12 months of the onset of symptoms, mood disorders such as depression or anxiety, poor emotional regulation, experiencing weight stigma and internalized weight bias, and dieting or other rigid, restrictive eating practices. So it is a complicated disorder, but yes, you can recover from it. Treatment options include guided self-help, psychological therapy, especially CBT, and/or medication. I will say that if you are looking for a therapist, please make sure that they are a qualified mental health professional, because binge eating disorder is a mental health condition. And there are lots of unregulated eating disorder coaches, some with absolutely no qualifications or training, charging hundreds and sometimes thousands of pounds. And some of these people may be doing more harm than good. So please, please be very, very careful. Okay, that's all I have for you today. If you like me in your ears, you might enjoy me in your inbox. You can sign up for my weekly newsletter where I tackle a different mental health theme every month. Things like the psychology of taste and flavor, love, and the psychology of money. You can sign up in the link in the episode description. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider either sharing it or leaving a positive review. I would appreciate that very much. And that just leaves me to thank you very much for listening. And until next time, take very good care.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.